Live from the Ken and Valerie Baker Studio at WHYY, this is Studio 2.
On Wednesday, September 24th, welcome to the show, powered by WHYY and you. I'm Cherry Gregg.
Pun alert, I'm Avi Wolf-Manarin.
I mentioned power, obviously, because I don't know if you've noticed, but electric bills are going up, up, up. And if you're like me, it's a shock to the system.
Second pun, you're on probation now.
Hey,
go ahead.
Look, but you and I are not alone. All across Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Delaware, prices are rising and fast, and the blame game is on. Pointing fingers at greedy AI data centers, a sluggish grid operator, politics around clean energy, and a whole lot more. It's even become a political sticking point in the New Jersey race for governor. There's also a fight brewing here in Pennsylvania. But what's signal, what's noise? Today, we'll talk about what's really driving costs, who's paying for big tech's power needs, and what fixes, policy, market, technology are needed to get our bills down. And we'll cut through the jargon. We have two pros. We'll get a little nerdy. We'll learn a lot about power today. And we want to hear from you. The questions of the day are this. What do you think is driving energy prices up? Have you seen your electric bills rise? And what kind of energy should we be investing in? The number is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on YouTube or Facebook, you know, share this video and put your comments in the chat.
Well, obviously, it's a very current topic, Cherry. And
pun alert! you're much punnier than I am.
I am.
So
no, but actually, I have to say, doing the research for this show, yeah. I learned more than I've learned for any show in a long time. This is an immensely complex topic, and one thing I like about this topic is that at the heart, it's really an engineering challenge.
Yeah.
And so everyone wants to make this about partisan politics, and there are partisan political implications. But at the end of the day, solving an engineering problem takes thinking that goes beyond the box of partisan politics. So we're going to do some of that thinking today with your help. Again, what do you think is driving energy prices up? Have you seen that electric bill rise? What kind of energy should we be investing in? Give us a call, 888-477-9499, email studio2@whyy.org. Should we do a trio of local news stories first?
Should.
Okay. So we're going to start with some good news here, actually.
Yay.
A major milestone for the city of Camden, New Jersey. This summer, the city recorded zero homicides.
Zero.
That's right. Zero over the course of an entire summer. It's the first murder-free summer in Camden in at least 50 years.
Wow.
And part of a larger story here in Camden. Back in 2012, the city had a murder rate that was nearly 70 times the national average. Camden was considered one of the most dangerous cities in America.
Wow.
Then they took a very dramatic step. They actually disbanded the city police department and replaced it with a countywide department. Since then, homicides have fallen 64%.
Wow. Wow, wow, wow. And this is huge because as a reporter, I covered the disbanding of the Camden PD and recall the county takeover. There was so much pushback. People were very upset. I also covered the community policing and all the hard work that the officers did. They were walking in the neighborhoods. They got to know people and they've invested in state-of-the-art technology and things turned around slowly but surely. I mean, Camden is not perfect, but the city's community policing efforts have become a national model. They hold events in the community, barbecues, open gym nights. They offer resources. And we've heard people say you can't arrest your way out of a crime problem. And they actually did the work. And I mean, these are the results. Zero homicides in a summer. I mean, that's the things that cities really dream about.
Yeah. And it's not just murders, by the way.
Yeah. Crime is down.
In 1991, there were 14,000 plus crime victims in Camden. By 2024, that number was down to 3,200.
Wow.
So it's all types of crime down, down, down in the city of Camden.
Yeah.
Story number two, we're staying in New Jersey now, Cherry.
Yeah. NJPBS, New Jersey's only dedicated public television station, is slated to shut down at the end of June of 2026. It's a sign of the times, and this decision to cease operation comes after really hard times for NJPBS. It used to be called New Jersey Network. It has had to deal with state funding cuts in addition to the federal funding cuts to public media. In 2025, their state funding went from $1 million down to $250,000. $1,000. And media experts in the Garden State, they say the impending closure was not a surprise, but with fewer newspapers focused just on New Jersey and this being their one public TV station now closing, it's going to be harder to get news coverage for the state. They'll have to be part of the regional coverage, right? Yeah. And NJPBS is not the only casualty of these funding cuts. A few days ago, we heard that WPSU, the Central Pennsylvania Public Media Station run by Penn State, it announced that it would be winding down operations also by the end of June. WHYY made a bid to transfer ownership of WPSU to WHYY, but that was rejected by Penn State. And by the way, WPSU TV covers 24 counties, the radio side, 13 counties, serving about 1.5 million people. So they won't have that free option available to them.
Yeah, you said it was a sign of the times, right?
Yeah.
And I should say it's not just about public media. It's all local news. The Newark Star-Ledger, for instance, no longer in existence as a print publication. And that was a pretty recent development. The truth of the matter is this. Local news has truly never been all that profitable as an endeavor. For a long time, it was subsidized by a few things. One was government,
yeah,
through things like the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and states. And then on the sort of the for-profit news side, it was things like advertisements and really classified ads.
Yeah.
I mean, that was a huge thing. So you could do a lot of reporting and then you had this sort of base of cash, this revenue stream to fall back on. It's all gone away. And so I think increasingly we're moving into a world where it's going to be philanthropy and viewers and listeners like you who make local news possible. This is not a pitch, by the way, at all. This is a reality. And it's not just for us. Think of The Inquirer. The Inquirer is run by a nonprofit now.
Yeah.
And they pursue grants. They pursue philanthropic dollars. That is it. To the extent that local news will survive, my prediction is it will survive on the backs of philanthropy, for better or for worse. Yeah. That's the world we're headed into.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's why when I said powered by WHYY and you, that is the truth. So yeah, sign of the times. Third story.
Oh yeah. So Philip,
You got excited about this story. So I'm sorry about that. You made me laugh.
All right. We good now?
We good.
Okay. Philadelphia Magazine recently reviewed a new restaurant in Fishtown called Percy. And in that review, they dubbed Percy Philly's most disappointing new restaurant. Said Percy was all style, no substance. They even said the breakfast sandwiches at Percy, quote, smell like feet.
Ooh.
Now, usually that's where the story would end, right? Bad review, restaurant tries to move on, salvage its reputation, et cetera, but the folks at Percy had other ideas.
Yes, they did.
They decided to print T-shirts that say, quote, Philly's most disappointing new restaurant, and they're donating the proceeds to the Fishtown Community Library. And I got to say, it feels kind of brilliant.
I love it. I say embrace the hate. Reclaim your power, make some profit, and give it to a good cause. I mean, what can you say? And you know what?
But that's the real trick here. They're giving it to charity, so you can't say anything.
Yeah.
You can't say anything to them.
You can't even get mad.
They're untouchable.
And, you know, I'm a Philly Mag fan, but I don't like these really bad restaurant reviews. I feel like
sometimes the
like, smell like feet, that was harsh.
You don't like bad restaurant reviews?
No, I'm not saying I don't like bad, but
it's journalism. If it's bad, it's bad.
That headline, ooh, punch in the gut.
Well, look, if they don't do bad restaurant reviews, you never know if the good restaurant reviews are sincere.
That is true, but I smell like feet.
I got no problem. I got no problem with the review, but I also got no problem with the clapback.
No,
good for them.
Absolutely not.
Take a negative, turn it into a positive. That's smart. At the very
least,
that's
good PR.
I don't know if the food's good, but I know the people that run this place are pretty clever. So yeah. I would say we should copy this. I think we should print shirts with bad reviews. I want to be in on this trend.
I kind of like that because I've been told I had bad taste. I should say CG equals bad taste.
One person said I was the most insufferable person on WHYY.
You go get a shirt that says insufferable.
The most insufferable person on WHYY.
I say
print
claim
it.
Claim it.
Big, bold letters, baby. Studio 2, worst program on the air.
That's right.
I love it. No, but seriously, I understand what you're saying. Sometimes there's clickbaity headlines with this stuff, or sometimes the writers go over the top. I thought this review, for the most part, was pretty fair.
They said the drinks were good.
Yeah, I thought, they didn't like the food.
And the vibe was good, but the food...
They don't like the
feet.
Food. They don't like the food. And I appreciate that restaurant reviewers are willing to tell it like it is. And I appreciate that business people are willing to to use it to their advantage. That's business, baby.
Yeah, you're right.
Take that thing and turn it into something that you can use.
And make sure your breakfast sandwich does not smell like feet.
That would be a start.
That would not be a start.
That would be a start. Okay. So now that we're all powered up here, we're going to talk about energy prices this hour. They are skyrocketing in this region.
So expensive.
And across the country. So why? We're going to explore that. We're also going to take a look at some possible solutions. We want to hear from you. What do you think is driving energy prices up? What kind of energy should we be investing in? Give us a call. 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back. The most insufferable show on the radio. We'll be right back. And welcome back to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Does it feel like your electricity bill is going up fast? And I mean, like, really fast. Well, it's not just you. Nationally, electricity prices are rising twice as quickly as the cost of living. Consumers and politicians are taking note.
Energy prices have become a central talking point in the New Jersey governor's race. Here in Pennsylvania, Governor Josh Shapiro is blaming the organization that operates the regional electric grid, threatening to withdraw Pennsylvania from this longstanding partnership.
So is Shapiro right? Is the grid the problem? Maybe it's data centers. Maybe it's the green energy transition. Maybe it's all of this and more. Today on Studio 2, a deep dive on rising electricity costs and what it says about our energy policy.
Let's welcome our guest. Patrick Cicero is the former consumer advocate for Pennsylvania. He's of counsel at the Pennsylvania Utility Law Project. Patrick, thanks for being here.
Oh, thank you very much for having me. Look forward to the conversation today.
Absolutely. And Abe Silverman is an assistant research scholar at the Ralph O'Connor Sustainable Energy Institute at Johns Hopkins. He was general counsel and executive policy counsel for the New Jersey Board of Public Utilities. Abe, nice to see you.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thank you.
And for all of you listening at home, on the road, and elsewhere, our questions of the day are this. What do you think is driving energy prices up? Have you seen your electric bill rise? And what kind of energy should we be investing in? You can join the conversation by calling 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on YouTube or Facebook, share the video and leave your comments in the chat.
Just a quick correction before we get started. Our producer's noting, I think in the intro to our show, we mentioned that PJM needs 5,000 gigawatts for AI data centers. It's actually 5,000 megawatts. You got to get your Latin
Mega
prefix right. Okay.
Yeah.
So let's, we're going to dive deep this hour, guys. But before we do any of this, we just need to lay out what exactly is driving up costs at the 30,000 foot level, right? So we know economics, right? There's supply and demand. And my sense is we've got supply problems here and we've got demand problems. So Abe, real quick, what's going on with supply and demand when it comes to electricity?
Yeah, well first I'll just say it is not your imagination. This is actually happening. And when we look, we have problems both on the supply and the demand side. For one thing, it's become very difficult to build new power plants, and it is now taking years to get new ones hooked up. At the same time, while we're having trouble bringing on new supply, we're having this amazing amount of new demand coming onto the grid, largely from data centers. And just to give you a little bit of a statistic, the entire PECO utility used approximately 8,651 megawatts on July 16th, 2024. And we are talking about adding data centers that would use almost that same amount of electricity to the grid every year between now and 2030.
Whoa. Which means as much energy as PECO was using in 2024 would be just for AI.
It's a mix, of course. Data centers come in all different shapes and flavors.
Sure.
But yeah, a lot of it is for AI. It's also for credit card processing and, you know, all sorts of other things. But yeah, we are really talking about adding a Philadelphia's worth of electricity, or if you want to think about it another way, five new nuclear power plants, the big ones, not the little ones, per year, every year between now and 2030, just to keep even with the amount of new data centers that are looking to come onto the grid. So there's a lot of reasons why the affordability question is getting so challenged. And, you know, there's plenty of blame to go around. But at the end of the day, we are seeing an amount of new load growth, that's what we call demand for electricity, We're seeing more demand now than we have since any time since basically we did rural electrification in the
Yeah,
United
that was going
States
to
in
be
the
my next
1950s and
question, actually,
60s.
for Patrick. Is like, is there any precedent for this? That where Abe is talking about this humongous demand for electricity, and it feels like it's coming so fast. Every single big tech company wants to make these investments. They want to make them today or yesterday. I mean, Patrick, have we ever seen anything like this before?
I think the short answer is no. I mean, even in the 1920s and 1930s, when we had mass electrification in the United States, we didn't have it that quickly, that fast, and all at once, right? This is really an everything everywhere all at once kind of concern. Before we get too far deep into the weeds, though, I do want to contextualize that in Pennsylvania, it is not just the generation side or the commodity side that is driving bill increases for consumers. Pennsylvania is a restructured state. What that means is distribution services, poles, wires, meters, the infrastructure to get electricity to homes and businesses is regulated by the Public Utility Commission. And the generation of electricity that we're here to talk about mostly today, driven by data center, AI load growth, and other things, is not, right? That is a market-based product governed by the rules of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission and kind of facilitated by PJM. But that side of the equation that PECO controls and the Pennsylvania Public Utility Commission controls, that is increasing too. There are distribution rate increases. And let me just give you some data on this. In 2022, the average household that heated with another source, heated with natural gas, heated with fuel oil, paid about $78 a month for their total electricity bill. In 2025, they pay $99 a month for their total electricity bill. If you heat with electricity, you paid about $275 a month on average in 2022. Now you're paying $350 a month on average in 2025. And this is going to keep going up and up and up as a projected as a result of the load growth projections. To put it into other contexts, based on the projections that PJM has, which is our regional electricity administrator, we can talk about them here in a minute. In 2030, we are projected to use something in the neighborhood of 64, 65, thousand megawatts of electricity, which is more than all of Texas.
Oh boy.
It's just new kind of AI data center load growth that's going to be happening. By 2032, we're talking about 88,000 megawatts or 88 gigawatts of new kind of load adjustments, not existing, but new load adjustments. And that's more than all of the kind of California, whole California system uses, just in new adjustments
Those are big states.
driven
Those
to
are
data
big
centers.
states, Patrick.
And these numbers, when you say this, it's sort of like, people can't even conceptualize like how much power this is and what that actually means for their pocketbooks. And so, Abe, I want to sort of ask you, like, what goes into the pricing structure? Because we're hearing, these AI data centers are going to be sucking power, and we're wondering, like, why in the world we have to pay for this? So what goes into
Can't
this?
they put segregate that money and pay for it themselves? I don't know how
It's
it
like,
works.
why is it my bill? Why are these data centers, why are they showing up on my bill? And if you could try to explain that, Abe.
The disbelief that you're expressing is one that a lot of us frankly share. This is an active topic of discussion going on every day with the PJM grid operator and with people working in the utility space and at the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission who oversees all this. That is like literally the billion-dollar question. But let's step back a little bit and talk about you get an electric bill at your house, and your electric bill really is comprised of two main costs. One is what we call the wholesale side of the bill, which is the electricity, paying for the power plants, paying for the transmission lines to get the electricity around. And that's approximately 50% of your bill. The other half of the bill is what Patrick was just talking about. On the distribution side, the poles and wires, the trucks, the linemen who come out and restore our power after an outage, meters and all, and taxes and fees and incentives. And so when we sort of look, part of the problem we're experiencing is it's not just one side of the bill going up, but we're seeing cost increases in every piece of the bill. And that is kind of what is really resulting in, I think, the sticker shock that a lot of customers are experiencing right now. So transmission costs are going up. We're building more transmission lines and they're getting more expensive. Obviously, all these new power plants that we need are very, very expensive. And then the poles and wires are getting more expensive. So, you know, it's kind of like your own home budget, right? Sometimes one cost goes up and maybe you save a little bit on the rent. In this case, every single piece of the electric sector is just getting more expensive. And those cap costs are showing up very quickly in consumer bills.
Yeah.
And so we're all sort of experiencing this. And, you know, I know it sounds obvious, but there's plenty of research out there that talks about what happens when electricity prices increase. Mm-hmm. And it particularly affects low-income customers and their willingness and ability to do things, you know, that a lot of us take for granted, like turn on the air conditioning in the summer. There is actual research that, you know, if you sort of look at income level, the temperature at which people turn on their air or their heating in the winter, it's different depending on how much money you make.
Yeah.
And that is, like, you know, really has to drive home just how important this is to everyday consumers. And I think that goes to why it's become such a hot button political issue.
Yeah. And to me, it says, and this goes to my question, and maybe Patrick, you can weigh in on this, because we talk about how the data centers are going to basically be equal. The amount of power that they're drawing in 1 year is going to be equal to the amount of power we all draw together as a collective. And I just wonder why it is, like, what kind of deals were made, Patrick, to where the regular residents who have nothing to do with this are now seeing both sides of their bill go up, as Abe mentioned, and we're footing the bill?
Yeah, it's a really great question. And it's as all great questions are, very complicated. But the simplest answer is you can think of electricity as a big old bucket, right? Mm. So there is the electricity that is generated, and then there's different siphons off that bucket for people who are using it, load, right? If you don't have enough generation, if you don't have enough actually electricity being generated, then the price for that electricity, like any other kind of commodity, is gonna go up. Right? It's a supply and demand problem. And really what we're seeing right now is two main drivers of drivers of these electricity price increases on the generation side. One is what's called capacity prices, which are dollars that are paid now for the future promise for a generating facility to be available in the future. That is, you know, we're going to pay you to be around in 2027 when we need you to be around. They also then get paid for the energy in 2027 that they actually generate. Those capacity costs are going up pretty remarkably. And let me give you some numbers about that. We had an auction last year for the capacity component of energy prices, of the prices in people's bills. And the result of that really started to get baked into utility bills in June of this year. When prices went up on June 1st in the PECO service territory, the average household who used 2,000 kilowatt hours a year, if they heated and cooled their house with electricity, would have had an increase in their price of about $22.50 a month.
Wow.
Almost all of that is the result of supply and demand dynamics related to data centers. So it's not because they're using more. It has nothing to do actually with the data center use now. It has everything to do with the data center use that's anticipated
the
and
capacity
expected
in the future.
Yeah.
So it, which is a huge part of the problem.
And I think I got this number here right. So I believe power suppliers, this is all the PJ, we'll talk about PJM later, but this is the big regional grid operator, power suppliers will receive a combined $16.1 billion from this auction that you talked about, up from $2.2 billion 2 years ago. So you can do the math on that.
That's right.
Two times eight is 16. So, but I guess the question that Tavoni, for instance, asked, this is really well put. Mm-hmm. Thanks, one of our listeners. Why can't electricity rates be progressive? So the more you use, the more it costs. So here I am, mm-hmm. you know, making sure I close the fridge or whatever.
Yep.
Trying to make sure I use this. I'm very energy conscious. And then I've got Microsoft or whomever, you know, sucking down energy by the bucket full. Like, why not just charge them more per unit use once you sort of are above a certain threshold? Patrick, is that just simply not feasible? Doesn't work that way? Does it work that way?
Well, it doesn't work that way currently, but it is feasible, right? I mean, you could have what is an inclining block structure, right, where you charge more for the more you use. Historically, we've not priced energy that way. In fact, sometimes people get a volume discount, right? You actually get
buy in bulk.
Right. So it is true that this is a significant concern. And, you know, I have less concern about that kind of like per unit cost than I do about, because they're going to pay for the energy that they use.
Yeah.
The question really is, how do we isolate the causal costs, the but-for costs, meaning, you know, if we didn't have this data center load growth, these costs wouldn't be spread to other ratepayers, whether it's those capacity costs I talked about, or the other side, the build out of the distribution and transmission system that is necessary to support this infrastructure. How do we isolate those costs and ensure that data centers pay in advance, and or ensure that they take and pay even if they don't use the energy in the future? Because let's think about this. The projections in PJM alone are for like 88 gigawatts by 2032. Mm-hmm. But if you look at the projections nationwide, we're talking about somewhere in the neighborhood of 50 or 60 gigawatts for the whole country. Wow. So there's some problem there. Not everyone's going to build in PJM. So there's a lot of people who are shopping around to try to get the best deal in jurisdictions that are driving up prices everywhere. And how do we address that problem, both on a cost allocation, how we allocate cost perspective, but also from ensuring that the electric distribution utilities, the electric utilities like PECO, don't build out more than
necessary. Sorry, Patrick,
I
want to clarify that. You're saying they're shopping around locking up future capacity that they're not actually going to use. Is that what you're saying? Or they might use, they might not use. But
and
we're all
right. And we're paying for it now.
Capacity.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. They're just like telling the electric companies, we're going to come in, right?
Yep.
And they might do a study. They might pay a small deposit for that study, but they're doing that not only in Pennsylvania, they're doing that in Virginia, and they're doing that in Ohio, and they're doing that in Texas, and they're doing that in North Carolina, and they're doing that, you know, in Arizona. And it may be the same data center everywhere, and then they'll only build at one place, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they might lose their deposits other places. But what that does is it drives up costs everywhere based on the projection that they might come.
Yeah.
And for them, it's just the cost of doing business. They don't care.
Yeah. Yeah. By the way, I want to invite you, our listeners at home, elsewhere, to participate in the conversation. Our questions are this. What do you think is driving energy prices up? Have you seen your electric bill rise? And what kind of energy should we be investing in? The number to participate, you got to call 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on YouTube or Facebook, share the video, but then drop your comments in the chat. John is really lucky. John says, we have green power through a Haddonfield-based company, flat rate, $100 a month, easy budgeting. I'm really jealous of John there. Gregory says, cryptocurrency mining and data centers are putting a tremendous strain on our power grids. Trump's trying to stop green energy production is not helping. I did wonder, Abe, I mean, these data centers are not a new thing necessarily. They're fairly new that we're talking about this, but this has been something in the works for a while. And if you think about it, you both said that, you know, we kind of think about this in the future, we're projecting. Why is it now we're sort of feeling the bite? If this was something that was in the works, in production for a while, did we not think ahead enough and start building out more gradually? Why does it seem like it's hitting us in the face in this moment, Abe?
Yeah, you know, data centers have been around for a while. I mean, computers aren't new, right? But the speed and the size at which the data centers are coming on is really unique post, I mean, frankly, the launch of ChatGPT in November 2022, I think it was. So you can go back and look at the load forecast from just a couple of years ago, and really all the 2010s and all the 2020s, we basically had slight increases in the amount of electricity we use as a society, but nowhere close to the kinds of quantities that we're seeing right now. And just to bring it down to brass tacks, there's someone called the Independent Market Monitor for PJM, who is a very trustworthy source who sort of oversees the markets and comes out with independent analysis. So, he recently looked at this and said that of the bill increases that we're seeing from the capacity piece, which is the majority of it, approximately 75% of the new higher prices are attributable to the data center load. I mean, let that sink in for a second. That's a huge amount of money. And as someone who, worked for a state that was investing a lot in clean energy, we would have titanic battles over a dollar or two additional cost per consumer per month for, say, an offshore wind farm. And now all of a sudden, we have the data centers coming in and we're seeing $20 per consumer per month increases. It's just amazing. And I really want to hit on something Patrick was talking about just a second ago. There is, in the midst of all the data centers, right? There is a lot of wheat and there's some chaff as well. So we often call this a ghost load. So a data center comes in, says, "Hey, I want to locate in Philadelphia." And they put in a relatively small fee, and then the utility incorporates them into their load forecast. And maybe that data center is really, two guys in a garage somewhere. Maybe it's Microsoft, but we don't necessarily differentiate between those. And yet the prices that we are seeing today is incorporating all of these projections about data centers. And we sort of done research on this in my group at Hopkins, where we look and say, all right, we are making 20, 30, 40-year investments on the backs of these data centers today in both the transmission grid, the distribution grid, and certainly in new generation. And yet we are not necessarily expecting that these data centers will be around that
So
long.
that's a huge problem.
Maybe we're in the midst of a
We have to get into that, Abe, because look, the obvious answer here, well, there's two answers. One is tell the data centers to kick rocks. I don't know how exactly
Build your own power structure
I don't know
grid.
exactly how you would do that, but let's put that aside for now. The other is to build out the grid, whether it's with renewables or not. And there's lots of different ways to do it. And what the dilemma you're bringing up here is so important, Abe, which is you can make a lot of long-term investments in the grid, but they might turn out to be overinvestments if indeed this is just a investment bubble in the AI data center space. So let's start to talk about, we have a lot of calls lined up. I'm
Yeah,
gonna get to them
maybe.
soon. But like, what do we actually do to increase supply? And is there a risk of over increasing supply?
Yeah, so I think you got to do two things. One is we really want to talk about how do we segregate out the cost of the data centers and insulate grandma from paying for Google's electric bill, right? That's piece number one. And then the piece number two is we really have to improve the quality of our load forecast. And that means, when a data center comes in, they don't just submit a piece of paper. They post real money. They agree to take power and transmission service for 10 years. They put up the appropriate
Yeah,
collateral,
skin in the game,
and then
skin
you
in the
charge
game.
them. Skin in the game. Absolutely. That's the name of the game.
You think we can get one caller in
Yeah,
before
let's
we go
get
to break?
Brad from Pottstown. Yeah, Brad from Pottstown's on line four. We're going to go to break after this call. Brad, you're setting us up for the second half of the show. What's your question or comment?
Part of the problem is the way the electricity is billed. You're not actually paying for the power you use. So turning off your lights really doesn't make a difference in your bill. It's the way the watt meter on your house functions. It's measured what's called reactive or imaginary power. And you'll have to look up the mathematics for that, where commercial users are charged on peak power for the day. So whatever they peak at for the day, that's what they pay for the whole day, whether they use it or not. Residential persons pay for what they use all day long in a form called imaginary or reactive power. And it can be up to 20% more than the power you actually consume. So you're not paying for the cost of the fuel that's burned at the power plant and that you're consuming in your light bulb and your refrigerator and the other appliances in your house. So you're paying for what's called, and if you look it up, you'll see the definitions of it, the technical details of what's called watt meter imaginary power. And it goes back 100 years. This is in the legacy of the, invention of electricity by Steinmetz and Edison and Tesla and all of those guys. And it's just what
Thanks, Brad.
came up, and it's way it works.
Yeah.
Thank you. Brad from Pottstown on the line.
Just wanted, like,
is there truth to what Brad is saying, Abe?
I think the specifics there may be a little bit garbled, but here's the key. When we use electricity, when you sign up with your electricity company, there is absolutely a piece of your bill that is fixed every month and that's very difficult to avoid. But it is still true that, you know, as I tell my 8-year-old, the cleanest electricity is the electricity you don't use. And so, yeah, shut off those lights. And one of the things we talk about a lot is actually how do we get people to care, both big companies and big corporations as well as homeowners? How do we get them to care about the amount of electricity they're using? And that is like a really cutting edge piece of rate design. It's, you know, really, we're really going down into the wonk hole when you get into those kinds of things. But it's about, you know, paying people or making it financially advantageous for them to use less electricity.
Yeah.
That is by far the best thing, you know, any of us can do.
And we're going
to lower our rates.
And Abe, we're going to have to go to a break. We're going to have to talk about the policies. Can we legislate our way out of this? How do we bring those bills down? Because clearly turning off the lights is not the whole thing. And so we want to hear from you. What do you think is driving energy prices up? Have you seen your electric bill rise? The number 888-477-9499. Email studio2@whyy.org. We'll be right back.
And welcome back to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. And we're talking energy this hour, why all of our electric bills are so high, the fact that AI is demanding a lot more electricity, and the impact that's having on all of us. So what can we do about our overworked power grid? How do we get more capacity? And let me reintroduce our guests. We have Patrick Cicero, the former consumer advocate for Pennsylvania. He's now a lawyer at the Pennsylvania Utility Law Project. We also have Abe Silverman, assistant research scholar at the Ralph O'Connor Sustainable Energy Institute at Johns Hopkins University. He was general counsel for the New Jersey Board of Public Utilities.
And our questions for you this hour: what do you think is driving energy prices up? Have you seen your bill rise? And what kind of energy should we be investing in? Call 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. If you're on YouTube or Facebook, drop a comment in the chat.
And there's so many directions, Abe and Patrick, we could go in now. But one of the things that popped in my head when you talked about the load forecast, Patrick, and just sort of some of the nicks in the system that some of these data centers and these big companies are exploiting. And I'm thinking, like, what public policy should we be focusing on? Because Pennsylvania wants to be this big AI hub. We see this sort of like coming fast at us. Are there opportunities for legislation, for policy that should be put in place that would help bring our bills down? And Abe, I'll start with you, and then Patrick, feel free to jump in.
Great.
Yeah, and I think you got to start at the regional grid operator level with PJM itself. PJM has recently initiated an emergency stakeholder proceeding. They're going to have something filed at the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission in December, which is lightning fast for this kind of thing. And the fundamental question is, what do you do if there's so much new data center load that prices keep going up, and also that we actually run out of electricity and get into a reliability crisis?
Mm-hmm.
So PJM is actively talking about this. This is something that the PJM Board of Managers, their highest level oversight, initiated only in August of this year. So while we've seen this coming for a little while, the policy response has been very slow.
Mm.
And the fact is right now that the data centers can get built, get funded, come online faster than our current regulatory processes can really handle. And so we're kind of getting a little bit, you know, we're a little bit caught on our back foot about this. And even our most sophisticated grid operators are dealing with this. So they have a proposal right now that would say, hey, if too much data centers come on, we're actually going to kick them off the grid if we're ever in a grid emergency.
Mm.
And that is enormously controversial.
Wow.
So you have the things that can happen sort of at that regional level. And then you also have the things that states can do. And Cherry, as you said, I mean, a number of states have very big incentives to bring data centers online. And I think in some ways, they haven't necessarily grappled with the cost to electricity consumers of doing that. And so there's a lot of steps that the utilities can take, overseen by the state, to do things like, we have what we call bring your own generation, BYOG, for new data centers, or bring your own clean energy generation, clean energy, which is Beyonce, which is like the greatest acronym in an industry full of acronyms. And the idea there is that the data center, maybe we should be requiring them, and we could do this through law. They have to bring their own generation, they have to pay for it, and it should be have a carbon content that reflects the state policy goals in which they're located.
Can I put that to you now, Patrick? Because one big question is, should politicians like Governor Josh Shapiro and many others throughout Pennsylvania be pursuing these data centers? And if so, what types of policies need to go with it? So it's sort of a two-parter, right? Like, do we actually want these? Should we actually want these? And if we do, what protections should be in place to make sure that they're not straining the grid beyond capacity?
Yeah, I think they're really great questions. We're not going back to a no data center world, right? The lived reality is, look, you're streaming this over YouTube. That takes a data center. Everyone is
We're part of the
getting
problem,
their
Jerry.
television.
We're using them.
Everyone
We're
is getting
using
their
them.
television through, streaming, and everyone's little miniature computer they have in their pocket has thousands and thousands of photos in it. And then you add on top of that generative AI, both from a text standpoint and an image standpoint. Like, we're not going backwards. So the lived reality is that we are going to have data centers, and there are real reasons why, for national security, for economic development, that we want those data centers in the United States as opposed to somewhere else, right? So the question is, how do we do this responsibly? Given the fact that electricity is a fundamental right, or at least it ought to be a fundamental right in terms of the ability of people to have access to this, amazing resource that we know as electricity, that, it's the closest thing to magic that I know, in
Totally.
terms of the way it actually works. And so, from this question about should we be pursuing it? Of course we should, right? Whether it's in Pennsylvania or it's in New Jersey or it's in Virginia, though, from a cost perspective,
We're all
doesn't
gonna
much
pay.
matter for PJM because we're all part of a whole statewide regional grid. And so really the question is, how do we manage
Is
that?
it
One way to
Beyonce?
do
Is Beyonce the answer here,
that,
Patrick?
bring your
Beyonce
own.
is an answer. Beyonce is an answer to many questions,
Yeah.
including this one. And it, again, for the listeners, Beyonce is bring your own clean energy, right? So it is a wonderful acronym that is about requiring data centers to ensure that when they come on board, they're bringing with them energy that not only is necessary to power in part or in whole the data center, but also provides attributes to the rest of us, to the grid, that is beneficial for all of us. So
Yep.
we can turn this into something that is actually beneficial to many of us if we pair up, if we match load with supply.
Let
So as
me,
a way to do that is to go ahead,
but we
Avi.
haven't, so the other thing we really haven't addressed in all this, though, because you're talking about increased supply, right? One of the big complaints with PJM, which we should reiterate, is this very large electric grid operator expands all the way to Chicago. In fact, we are part of it, right? One of the big complaints with PJM is they have this huge backlog of new energy projects, a lot of them green energy projects, that people say we can't get them approved, we
Too
can't get them
slow.
linked up to the grid. So is that legitimately a big problem, Patrick? And if so, what is the way to expedite that process so that when I've got my solar field plan ready to go, I can get that thing vroom, plugged right into the grid?
Yeah, it's a huge problem, right? The interconnection queue, as it's called, the line to get connected to the grid, is long, slow, and Byzantine in terms of processes. PJM has developed some kind of fast track processes to expedite things. One of the things in central Pennsylvania is expediting getting Three Mile Island back online, hopefully by 2028, which is carbon-free energy, right? In terms of
Nuclear.
its carbon emissions. So that's a good thing. So they are making some changes on that, and that's good. I think the thing that's important to know, though, even if you get through that queue, that line, and PJM gives you your little hall pass to connect to its system, that doesn't necessarily mean that the generation gets built. There could be local siting and permitting.
Yep.
There could be supply chain constraints.
More red tape. Yeah. Yay.
Exactly. Right. Yeah. Like, you know, if you're not in line right now for a turbine to actually fuel your power plant, to generate the electricity from the fuel you're burning, it's got to be 5 or 6 years until
Wow.
you
Sorry,
get
real quick follow up though. Real quick follow up though for Abe. Like, isn't there a good reason sometimes for that red tape? Those are guardrails, right? Sometimes
for the
these
community.
Processes exist for a reason, whether it's PJM's, you know, guardrails or it's the local permitting guardrails. Like, I guess the question is how much of that should we get rid of before we risk, you know, some other knock on problems?
You have to deal with community engagement and local siting and permitting issues. It is absolutely one of the big delays. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I don't want to let PJM off the hook too easily here, because in a lot of ways, there is no excuse for how long it takes to get a new generator through the PJM process.
Yeah.
So, you know, if I were back in my days of developing generators, we would come in with a request to interconnect. We would go get our local siting and permitting things in parallel. And it basically took around 2 years to do all that paperwork. And then we would be doing them in parallel, and then we'd build. And that's a system that worked. But now the PJM process is so long and so uncertain that often if I go in and get a permit, the permit's expired by the time I get through the PJM interconnection queue.
Yeah.
And this is, you know, one of these classic good news, bad news stories, because one of the reasons that the queue is so broken is we've had so many investors and people wanting to buy clean energy that we went from having, you know, 10, 20, 100 projects coming into the PJM asking for service a year to thousands.
Yeah.
And so it's kind of been like the whole system collapsed under the weight of demand for new clean energy, which is both, you know, really exciting and also a little bit tragic.
Yeah.
And so this is one of the things that PJM is perennially working on.
Quick question, because, you know, Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro has threatened that Pennsylvania would leave PJM. Would that move the needle at all and bring our bills down? Would that do anything, Patrick?
Oh, I don't know. That's a really good question.
But it's a threat, you know, that's out there.
That's a good response, though.
The threat is easier to make than the actual
reality,
enactment of it. It is really hard to figure out how to do this. And, you know, can it be done technically? Yes. Would it speed things up? Probably not, right? Mm-hmm. Because you'd have to develop a whole parallel system. Like, somebody has to be in charge of the kind of air traffic control system that is our electricity grid, balancing supply and demand 24/7, 365. And that is what PJM does really well, that operational aspect. So it's this, operating the system, PJM does pretty well. Planning the system, which is what we're talking about, right, is where we're in struggle, we have struggles. Planning both the new generation to match the load and the transmission upgrades that are necessary, that's where we run into problems. And so getting back to this question about what can be done is, requiring, if you have an interconnection queue for requests for generation, require a load queue, right? Matching those things up so that you can get in line at the same time to kind of build here when there's generation to match the amount that you have, whether you're building it or whether you're helping to pay for it systemically. Those are multiple different options. And the reality is that we're going to have to slow down in order to ensure that all of us continue to have access to energy. And I think that that's really important. As Abe mentioned, PJM is planning for what it looks like for a supply shortage. And that's really, what does it look like to do rolling blackouts, right?
Yeah.
PJM calls it load shedding. Mm-hmm. That's a really euphemistic way of saying turn people's lights off, right? And so the question really is, whose lights are we turning off first? My argument is that it should not be regular folk who've been here relying on the system and paying for it. It should be these new drivers of demand, which are causing us to be in this supply shortage in the first place.
And we only have about a minute left in the show. So I want each of you to take like 20 seconds and just sort of say, if you had one thing you would focus on, if you were in charge, I love you're given the king for a day hat and you could make a change, what would that be to help drive down some of these costs and relieve the everyday person? And Abe, and then final word to you, Patrick.
Yeah, I mean, the first thing I do is deploy. You take the projects that are shovel ready. You move heaven and earth to get them built. And there's a lot of projects in that category. And it's just a matter of having the political will to actually do it. The second thing is I would come in and say, okay, data centers, we are going to insulate retail, existing retail customers from the financial impacts of what you're doing. And the third thing I would say is, you know, this is a regional problem that is very much less tied to clean energy than people think it is. The PJM system is a relatively low clean energy system, only about 10%. And we're seeing these same concerns raised by people like Governor Youngkin in Virginia, very, very Republican, as well as Governor Shapiro here in Pennsylvania, and by Mikey Sherrill and Jack Cittarelli in New Jersey.
We do have to go. I'm so sorry, Patrick.
But
I have to apologize to Jay and from Hamilton, Tom from Gladwin, who had some great calls. John had a great comment on China. We had Chris from Allentown, who's a nuclear power expert, had a great comment as well. Sorry we couldn't get to those, but I do have to thank our guests who were fantastic.
Yeah, I learned so much.
Patrick Cicero, former consumer advocate for Pennsylvania. Thank you, Patrick.
You're welcome.
And Abe Silverman, who used to be general counsel for the New Jersey Board of Public Utilities, now over at Johns Hopkins. Abe, thank you for your time.
Oh, thank you.
Yes, and thanks to Debbie Builder, Andreas Copes for producing today's show, Mike Schiffler, our visual producer, Al Banks, and Tina Calicay engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCrory. From Studio 2, powered here at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg.
I'm Avi Wolfman-Arrett. Talk to you tomorrow.